Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Schinnemann, president and founder of ReviewLess. Welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you hit your iPod, iPad, computer, you know, whatever device you're listening to this on. And I'd like to say, although we've taken a little bit of a break from shows, I think we're restarting up with a very interesting show today on using contracts to reduce e-discovery risk. Back in 2012, Jay Bruds and Jonathan Redgrave wrote a fantastic and thought-provoking article entitled Using Contract Terms to Get Ahead of Prospective e-Discovery Costs and Burdens in Commercial Litigation. It was published in the Richmond Journal of Law and Technology, also known as JOLT. The citation is 18 Rich JL and Tech 13. We're going to talk about this article in depth on today's show, but it's really worth reading. And unfortunately, like many good ideas, it hasn't been immediately picked up by the legal community. And, you know, I think of things like Rule 502D or using e-discovery special masters, Form B in the Southern District of New York's complex litigation. Let's throw predictive coding in there. I mean, there's so many innovations that just aren't grabbed right away, that I know it's frustrating for a lot of us that are entrepreneurial in the space. I'm sure it's frustrating for the authors, and I imagine that's one reason why now, you know, well over a year. How long has it been since it was published? A year and a half ago?
Yeah, I believe it has been a year and a half.
Yeah, we're going to talk about it today, and I think not a lot of people have talked about it, but it's a great article, and we're not going to trash the mechanisms for spreading education to lawyers in the field. We're just going to do a free podcast and do our bit to get the word out. So our guest on the show, Jay Bruds, is a partner in Drinker Biddle's Commercial Litigation Practice Group and a member of the Data Management and Discovery Team. He's also an officer of the firm's e-discovery subsidiary, Drinker Discovery Solutions, LLC, which provides state-of-the-art e-discovery technology and services to the firm's clients. Jay previously served in several roles focusing on the intersection of applied technology and law, including senior counsel for legal technology at General Electric, where he created and led their corporate e-discovery center, supporting over 1,200 attorneys. In this role, he was also responsible for all corporate technology initiatives within GE's legal operation, including the successful implementation of legal hold, e-billing, insider trading compliance, intranet, and patent docketing system. Jay also has an extensive background in computer forensics and computer programming from past positions. He's a skilled and frequent speaker at legal industry events on topics of legal technology and e-discovery. I might add, he was recently a guest facilitator at our New York City Predictive Coding Bootcamp series, which I've been bringing around the country. So, Jay, thanks for joining us on the show.
Well, thank you for having me, Kyle.
We also have a past frequent guest, Jonathan Redgrave, who co-authored the article. And Jonathan has an extensive experience in all areas of complex litigation in both state and federal courts and focuses his practice in the areas of information law, which include electronic discovery, records and information management, and data protection and privacy issues. He's authored, co-authored, and edited numerous publications, including serving as editor-in-chief of the Sedona Principles, speaks around the world on topics including cross-border discovery, information governance, privacy, data security, and emerging technologies. Jonathan helped found, was the first chair of, and is currently chair emeritus of the Sedona Conference Working Group on Electronic Document Retention and Production, which is Working Group 1. He also serves on the advisory board of the Sedona Conference. Jonathan was a founding co-chair of the Georgetown University Law School eDiscovery Institute. Jonathan also serves on the advisory committee on the Electronic Records Archives for the United States National Archives and Records Administration, and is a member of the International Association of Privacy Professionals, along with several other trade and bar associations. He's also done a number of ESI Bytes podcasts in the past. Jonathan also has a great sense of humor and observed recently when we were talking about my lack of ESI Bytes podcasts and said, that's a good indication of how busy I might be professionally, and that's an astute observation. However, I love doing these shows. I'm going to continue adding them even while I'm busy, if the right topics and speakers come before me, as they have in this show. So let's start off here. First of all, Jay, since this is your first time doing ESI Bytes, I always like to ask how you first got started in electronic discovery Jonathan, you've been on this many times, so we're just going to bypass you on that question. Jay?
Well, that's a good question. The thing is, I grew up as kind of a nerdy kid. If you remember Matthew Broderick in the movie War Games, that was kind of the kind of kid I was, although I never seemed to get the Ally Sheedy character to like me. I actually, when I was about 10 or 11 years old, I had a Data General terminal in my room. I don't know if you remember good old Data General, with a 300 baud acoustic coupler modem, the kind that you jam the old Ma Bell phone into. And that's how I got started there. So when I got out of law school and I joined GE, it kind of naturally fell to me to sort of set up the systems for managing the big complex cases. This is in the 90s. Those are the days of scanning and coding documents. We started with that and then gradually morphed into email, and I fell into computer forensics at that point too, and for a while did some programming. So I had done that for a while. And then, you know, just the industry sort of swept me up, as it probably did with everyone else, and everything became e-discovery, and now e-discovery is just discovery. So that's how I came around to it.
Actually, I remember, Jonathan, you had a different computer that you played with when you were a child, as I recall. I can't remember which one it was, but I just remember.
Carl, it was the Osborne, which is the world's first portable computer at 24.5 pounds.
Oh, the Osborne?
Yeah, you gotta get a workout.
Luxury. I would have killed for an Osborne.
Well, Jonathan, since you've been on the show and you are an industry pioneer, why don't you tell us why you think it takes so long for helpful ideas to cross through the e-discovery marketplace? I alluded to that in the beginning, and it's something that bugs me a lot.
Well, if we were truly pioneers, it takes a long time because our horses are slow. Personally, that's not a good explanation today when we actually have airplanes, telephones, and the internet. The reality is the legal industry is one of the last adopters of both technology and, I think, innovation. In fact, many people don't really associate lawyers with the concept of innovation. All you have to do is look at some Dilbert cartoons where the lawyers are parlayed into fools somewhat. Now, the reality is lawyers are appropriately cautious. There's a lot of good reasons why lawyers look at change with a skeptical eye to understand what does that mean for clients? How does that square with legal standards? In fact, when we think about law school training, a lot of people go back to stare decisis, which is that built notion of the common law evolving, which requires a considerable amount of time. So when we talk about, like in this particular case, an article that goes into, hey, maybe we can change the rules of the game through contract, that is somewhat a notion that I think a lot of lawyers pause and say, well, but maybe I need something. And maybe if I give it away, I won't be able to help my client later down the road. So there's a fear factor that goes into change naturally. I think there's a fear factor that goes into change related to this particular topic. So throughout the e-discovery marketplace, whether it's predictive analytics, whether it was even going offshore with review, anything that changes the status quo, there's a reaction against, you know, a body of arrest tends to stay arrest. Well, with respect to the legal profession, you know, don't rock the boat. We've been doing this for years. Don't rock the boat. In fact, one of the things that we confront with clients is that there may be very, very many options in front of a client that would reduce the cost of doing discovery. Some of those options might require a whole different approach to it, whether you have national e-discovery counsel rather than relying on all your outside counsel, whether it's using strategic vendors rather than whoever your outside counsel picks, whether it's having a streamlined in-house processing capability and even initial calling capability, all those things are different. And so people, again, are resistant to that, even though when you actually step back, you look at the perspective. If you undertook those changes, you could probably reduce the risk of loss or the risk of any sanctionable conduct through inadvertence or negligence while also streamlining that process to get much greater efficiencies. This is the kind of stuff that Jay eats and breathes and sleeps because he's known this for years and he's been very successful with clients in his prior lives implementing those kind of programs. But there aren't that many people like Jay that are out there that are kind of innovative But I think that, you know, to some of your question, that's what's going on, Carl. There's just this natural, we've been doing it this way for a long time. I don't really need to change. It's working, isn't it? And no one steps back and looks at that bigger picture of efficiency and risk. But with that said, one last thing, and I'll kind of get off this long-winded answer. I think people are beginning to change. People have realized how much money they've spent in the e-discovery space, and we're getting to what Malcolm Gladwell would call a tipping point.
Well, that's good. So let's talk about the article a little bit, and you can both answer this. You may have different perspectives on it, but first of all, Jonathan, how did the idea come up to write this article?
Well, I'm not sure if Jay and I were drinking at the time.
there was probably a glass of wine involved.
Yeah,
could have. I mean, Jay, I mean, I don't remember if alcohol was involved, but I know Jay had raised this with me as a concept, and I think I had, in my head, had thought of similar ideas, and I was just kind of absolutely glued into this, and, you know, maybe Jay's got a better story to that.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, one thing I could say is, you know, Jonathan and I both do a lot of statistical sampling, and I can say, probably statistically, we could make the statement that there probably was bourbon involved. But other than that, I think, you know, this started to be spoken of by some of my colleagues as a potential way to address a problem that was killing them. So, and what was killing them was, you know, we hated being lawyer. You kind of hate to be a lawyer when you're on the business side and you don't have a good answer. And what was happening was people were saying, look, you're 100% right. You're completely in the right, but settle this case because it's going to cost you more to litigate it than you're going to make. Or, you know, it's just not worth it, right? So just settle it because e-discovery is costing too much. And it's so it wasn't just a cost thing. The cost was driving behavior there, and that was driving people crazy, right? So that's an answer when you're in-house, you hate to have that answer. You want to be able to tell people, you know, yes when you can, no when you must, but you hate to be able to say, look, you're completely right, but it doesn't matter because, you know, the system that I am an interface to for you is messed up in this way, and it costs more to resolve these conflicts than the price of the conflict. So that kind of is what drove it.
Well, we can talk. I guess one of the big drivers here was costs, and you know, when we're talking about cost estimates for e-discovery, a lot of people look to the RAND Institute for Civil Justice, which released a really nice comprehensive study of 8 companies and their litigation costs, and estimated the median costs in the 57 cases they examined from large companies were a collection of $1,300, basically $2,700 for processing, review cost $13,000, but $636. But for companies with hundreds of active cases or just matters where litigation is reasonably anticipated, these numbers balloon rather quickly. So, Jay, what is your sense of the cost side of e-discovery from your experiences and research? You know, are you experiencing those sort of you know, never-ending growth cycles?
Yeah. So directionally, I think the RAND numbers are directionally okay. You know, I mean, it's the thing is, if you tell a business guy this is going to cost you a buck, he's going to say that's too much. I want to pay 50 cents. So no matter what, everybody's going to say it costs too much, right? Nobody's ever happy with how much they're spending on litigation. You know, the problem is the cost spiked disproportionate to a lot of different things, to the value, to what we were used to paying in the past. And then the other side of it is, you know, we all knew that so much of what we were doing did not actually further the case. So there was the cost numbers, which the cost is huge, but it's just wasteful. You know, we review so many documents that are just wasteful. We preserve so much more because we're on, you know, we're preserving defensively. We over-preserve. That preservation becomes perpetual because you have other cases that come in that maybe impact something that you're preserving for another case. So you can never get rid of anything. So the direct costs are, you know, the RAND kind of covers that. Then, you know, I remember they did something on preservation a while back, and the cost of over-preservation is huge. And not only that, but that over-preservation just causes gridlock because you can't, you know, you have to suspend the normal operation of certain systems. You have to, you know, it does start to affect your business there. So the costs are actually beyond what you're paying an e-discovery vendor, beyond what you're paying your lawyer. There's a lot of other costs that are sort of secondary and tertiary to that that add up in a tremendous way.
I want to talk about the article, but since we've referenced alcohol tying into e-discovery, I think I'll give a little plug now for my take on alcohol and e-discovery. I had originally started with a fourth C based on Zuba Lake, where the three C's of Zuba Lake are communicate, coordinate, comply, which are hard. So the fourth C was Cabernet. And I handed out hundreds of these bottles to lawyers around the country. They all loved it. It was funny. Judge Shinlin and Laura Zubelake both autographed it. I then sort of joked that we left a new realm, or about 2011, where we had a new 4C, which I never bottled, called Collect Cabernet. And, you know, that's, I think, a lot of the reason why the costs continue to go up and up. We just have so much data. And I've now focused on a new 4C, so I'm hoping that this doesn't become something that people don't recognize, like a lot of good ideas, but it's coordinate, cooperate, communicate, and share a Cabernet. And we have an anonymous judge ready to autograph the label once we get it into production. But anyway, until we have that alcohol blend out there, let's talk about your book or your article here. What exactly are you proposing and using contract terms to get ahead of prospective e-discovery costs and burdens in commercial litigation? So mechanically, Jonathan, what was your thought process?
Well, you know, I was distracted when he started talking about your four C's again and the wine. And I will say, to tag on to Jay's comment about over-preservation, think about if you actually had to preserve everything in making wine, you'd be drinking the skin of the grapes, you'd be drinking all the seeds, you'd be drinking all the pulp. So there's a reason why we actually strain things. There's a reason why we actually narrow things down. I think people should think about that. There's just a reality to over-preservation that is expensive, and it actually dilutes the value of what you get in the end. Now, how do contracts potentially help? And this is your question particularly, Carl. What do we have in mind here? Well, contracts are used among commercial entities and then also commercial to consumer for a variety of purposes. Sometimes it might be the choice of law or venue, jury trial waiver, all sorts of things. And there's mediation, arbitration clauses. And so what the concept was, can we create some sort of structure contractually that could help with respect to discovery? And I think the answer, when you read through the article, but then it's just intellectually, is sure. And so what were we trying to do? Well, how can we decrease the uncertainty that exists out there, whether it's did someone preserve in a timely manner? What was the scope? Is there some way we can limit, you know, what you have to do from the get-go? Is there some way we can dictate in advance a framework for managing disputes? Is there some way we can imbue in the contract a sense of both cooperation and efficiency? And so the kinds of contractual limits we talk about in the article and promote, talking about no preservation duty absent notice to the other side, so there's no gotcha game, limiting the amount of preservation and discovery in advance, so there's a specific need to identify or specify what the other side wants. There's a framework for that discussion, and again, no gotcha games. There's also a discussion of having procedures for allocating discovery costs in advance so that it's not you get to the show, so to speak, with respect to an arbitration or litigation, and everyone's, you know, getting a free-for-all about what they want and maybe arguing about cost allocation. No, there's actually a procedure in advance, so the parties, again, largely in the commercial context, have thought about in their business risk analysis and their business analysis has said, let's allocate the risk of a dispute by knowing up front how we're going to deal with discovery costs if something goes south. And then, of course, agreeing in the contract to restrict the kind of sanctions that either side can seek for a discovery violation. So those are kind of ideas that were built into it, plus, I suppose, elements of indemnity if someone breaches that element of the contract. So if someone goes hog wild and seeks sanctions when they agreed not to, there'd be a penalty provision for that that could be enforced just like an arbitration clause. So the idea was to build common sense, so to speak, into these agreements so that the business, again, took control and not just the lawyers after the fact, with respect to both the risks and the costs involved in dispute resolution.
And Jay, there's precedent for this thesis, right? I mean, if you look at contracts, you drew on some precedent for why you thought people could be doing this. You want to articulate some of them?
This is what I was thinking, because I had a weird practice because I started at a small business in GE, and so I did both transactions and litigation. So I have a certain background in transactions, and I was thinking, boy, we would specify a lot of stuff. We would specify choice of law. We would specify choice of venue. You would waive a jury trial. Now these are all in contracts between generally sophisticated parties of equal bargaining power. And you could do all these things. Arbitration clauses, right? Arbitration is a big thing. Now arbitration isn't an exact analog because you're supported by the Federal Arbitration Act, but that's sort of the general thing you can do. But with the other ones, I mean, choice of venue, choice of law, we could pick all sorts of stuff. You could specify you can specify liquidated damages. You could specify equitable relief. You could do all of those things in your contract. Why not do this? Why not say, okay, your obligation to preserve begins when you get notice, right? Who wouldn't love that? I mean, who among us in the e-discovery world wouldn't love if your obligation to preserve started at a date certain, not something oddball? Well, that would be great. Well, we could write that in the contract. Now, not every case where you're taking e-discovery is a contract case, right? You're not always getting sued on a contract. But if you were, there's a couple benefits to that. One, if you were getting sued in the contract, these govern. Another benefit that I see of that aspect of it is it sort of helps educate the judiciary, helps educate various other parties as to what's reasonable in a given situation. So in other words, if these provisions get into a lot of contracts and they're litigated and they're found to be reasonable, then you have another case that's maybe not a contract case, but it's similarly valued. Well, kind of what two parties of equal bargaining power would have agreed to, right? It helps set the bar for what's reasonable in cases where there's maybe not a contractual term. So that's to me another benefit that is sort of an externality here. That's away from the question you asked, but that's basically sort of what I was thinking.
Yeah, is one of the challenges, and this is something that sort of struck me as I've been really trying to think why people aren't doing this in larger numbers, is one of the challenges that to really institute this, you need corporate lawyers in tune to all the pain caused in e-discovery, which is primarily either, a corporate, writing the check pain, but within law firms, if law firms are negotiating the contract, the corporate lawyers and law firms aren't necessarily attuned to these issues because they're not in the contract forms they're dragging up from the prior transaction they've done. I mean, they're not really being educated in e-discovery. Is that really the biggest challenge here?
One of the worst jokes I had ever heard was at a closing of a heavily negotiated contract. We signed it, and the lawyer for the other side says, "Great, that's done. I'll bring this over to my litigation department in the morning." Talk about a joke that does not go over well. But really, a big part of it is litigators don't talk to contract lawyers, and contract lawyers don't talk to litigators. Really, there's not a lot of interplay there, which is kind of funny. It's kind of funny because I know a lot of carpenters who have gone to the plywood factory to see how plywood is made, because that's your raw material. Litigators, contracts are a big part of your raw material, but you don't see as much interaction between the two.
Just seems to me like it adds so much value when you're interacting with a corporation of being creative to be presenting ideas like this. But that's maybe a question for at the end of the show. But let's go through some of the pain points of e-discovery, which all drive up costs. And let's talk about how a contract can solve this problem. I think you've touched on some of this, but, preservation costs, Jonathan. How expensive is preservation, and how does this article address these concerns through contracts?
Well, there's a couple things about preservation. Studies have shown that you know, just the over-retention of information that clogs the ecosystem by some measure that it actually pollutes, if you think about it with a water analogy, it kind of pollutes the data in organization. But having bad data that's hard to kind of get through, the cost of the economy, I think there's a study 2 years ago that put it at like $3.1 trillion, some astounding number. Now, how much of that is really over-preservation versus just companies over-retaining? Well, either way, over-preservation really pushes into the total over-retention in organizations. Now, down on the granular level, I was listening at a conference the other day, Patrick Koop, who is with the EDI, Electronic Discovery Institute, was noting that while it sounds attractive to say, hey, you can just preserve things by going down to Best Buy and pick up a, you know, a terabyte drive, the reality is you got to account for the identification, the actual collection of the information, the assurance of validity in the collection mechanism, the people to make sure it's stored correctly, the maintenance of that storage system. And when you look at all the numbers, and I think the GAO on the government side looked at it, I mean, it's multiple thousands of dollars per individual on a custodian basis, even though you think, well, it must be cheap. It isn't in reality. There are a lot of attendant costs to preservation, and when you multiply against tens or hundreds of employees, it gets huge very fast. In terms of what you're going to see out in the world, a lot of testimony before the Federal Advisory Committee on Civil Rules, the Rules Committee, looking at the new proposed rules of civil procedure, you're going to see more data getting into the record on the true cost of preservation, and it is not cheap. Now, the reality is it a pain point? Absolutely. You know, maybe people haven't seen the dollar numbers drop to the bottom line. It's not like you have a budget for preservation. But people are beginning to see, especially with the look back to 2006, 2005, when people read Zubalike, they saw the new rules then and said we need legal hold programs, but didn't really think about releasing legal holds. And then they were just throwing them on, you know, as broad as possible. They're now reaping what they've sown. And the cost of trying to get rid of information today is enormous. So I think people are looking at, is there a better way to do this? Is there a way to get rid of legacy information? But on the better way to do it going forward, well, these contract provisions are ways in which you can really cabin the scope of your preservation from the get-go in advance, or at least have a process built into the contract in the commercial disputes where you're going to have a quick discussion. Again, at the outset, you know, any contractual relationship between business entities, they've got an incentive to work together. They've got an incentive to cabin business risk and cost. And it's just common sense in my view, and I think Jay's as well, that by having provisions that kind of enforce that are second nature. Now, it may not be second nature to a litigator, but like any good lawyer, you should understand the client's interest and act in the client's best interest. And if there was a provision by which the parties have to negotiate in a dispute resolution situation about the scope of preservation, well, by golly, follow the law and the contract. And I think people will. It's just a matter of getting over this kind of initial sticking point for people to realize the client interest can be well served by such provisions.
Yeah, and I'd like to echo that, especially the client interest portion of it, because to me, this is a little bit of a statement against interest. Because a good part of my business is actually advising clients on how they can get rid of stuff that they've preserved in the past that they think they no longer have an obligation, but they're not sure, and how could you defensibly get rid of that stuff? So once you preserve, you know, it's kind of like nuclear waste or you know, it's just with you forever. Or, you know, in my neighborhood, it's kind of like changing your own oil. You know, I don't know what to do with the oil when I'm done with it. I got no place to put it, and I don't know where to go with it. And that's kind of what happens with this preserve stuff. So it just builds up in your garage until you have to then pay somebody like me to tell you what you can get rid of and what you can't. And, you know, it'd be nice, you know, it'd be a wonderful world if nobody had to do that.
Yeah, I remember doing a podcast earlier this year with Judge Grimm and David Howard, who was part of the rules process. They wrote the Microsoft letter cataloging their costs, and Judge Conte was on the show. And I was hoping we'd come up with the answer on the show on how do you, you know, come up with a better way to reduce the preservation burden from being out of hand. Because frankly, in my space, which is analytical review, the size of the data sets is what causes the biggest problems with these tools, be it either the tools crap out or it gets harder to find what you want to find in the case. You know, it's the needle in the haystack. There's a lot of crap and not a lot to grab onto that's responsive. And I remember at the end of the podcast thinking, wow, that was tiring, but we didn't solve the problem. So it's neat hearing ideas that I think are practical that can actually attack pieces of the problem. So let's go beyond preservation. Jay, can you think of ways that contractual techniques can actually limit the costs of e-discovery beyond preservation, like reducing the amount of discovery performed?
Yeah, that's you know, probably the biggest part. So, you know, the philosophy here is less is less. And how many, you know, we've all said this, you know, Jonathan, I think, might have said this, you know, when you go to trial, how many exhibits do you actually have? And how many people do they come from? You know, so one of the things is let's limit the sources of data, because each new source of data, each new custodian really adds to the complexity, the scope, and most of all, the volume of how much work we have to do and how much cost there is. So let's limit the number of sources. Let's limit the number of custodians. Let's limit the number of systems we look at. Let's look at you know, how we manage disputes. Let's talk about cooperation, because we know cooperation does save money and streamlines the resolution of the dispute. And you know, to me, those are the key things. Is you know, put some numbers or some solidity around preservation. You know, so when does duty attach? What do you have to preserve? That kind of stuff. Then same thing on data sources and system data, or sort of custodians and system data sources. And then a framework to sort of streamline the whole thing.
You know, it's funny. I chaired a meeting yesterday at our Friends of eDiscovery group in Pittsburgh, and we were talking about the Special Master Program. And we had a few of us that have been Special Masters thus far in the programs, and we got up and we talked about our cases. And the one common theme of all of the examples is that it saved money. And the initial reaction, a lot of the experts I talked to, including some judges in New York, when they heard of the idea of using a special master, was, oh my God, that'll cost a ton. That's extra cost. But you know, what people don't recognize is it's like tapping in the Siri, you know, in your iPhone. You've now got a database and an expert that's sort of steering and trying to push people to do practical things based on a depth of experience, if you've got a good special master. And I can think of something like that could be built in if you've got two, you know, smart parties that say, hey, we want to get a smart resolution. There's no end to being creative with these things, Jay.
I think so. And I, you know, personally, I think now with all the stress on technology-assisted review, you know, you could, even if you wanted to be way out there, you could specify, you know, you might not specify the exact technology tool that you'll use, but you might specify that you would use a technology, you would, you know, one party would not object to the use of technology-assisted review, as long as it, you know, happened within certain bounds, meets and bounds. And I think you could do that. I think you could specify that. You know, I say that now, as soon as this podcast hits, I'm sure there'll be 20 technology-assisted review vendors giving me model language to insert into an update to the article.
They might start with sharing the null set, which is be such an easy one. And I was going to save that for the end of the podcast, because I can't go without adding something in predictive coding to any of these topics for some reason. It's just drilled into my head. But anyway, so Jonathan, you know, arbitration and mediation clauses are in contracts. You know, do you see those types of tools being used for e-discovery and dictated in the terms of the contract?
Well, yes and no. I mean, obviously, arbitration and mediation clauses are a legion in many commercial contracts. What we have yet to see is that people are beginning to turn those into clauses that include how to limit ESI or how to at least deal with it in a more efficient fashion. Now, whether you're in the CPR world or some other world with respect to alternative dispute resolution, you know, each of those organizations, AAA, will have rules with respect to discovery. And what we're seeing, unfortunately, is that the arbitrators are often looking at large matters and saying, well, you know, we, and they're falling back on, they go, you know, we really need a lot of discovery here. And then they just fall back on that. And the rules, as you may know, provide significant latitude to an arbitrator or a panel of arbitrators about allowing discovery. And so it seems like, in many ways, an ungoverned arbitration or an unscripted arbitration before you get into it is something where it's a very unfortunate thing, because you're in the same soup as a civil litigation sitting in federal court or state court, but you don't even have the procedural abilities to run in and get relief the same way you would in the federal or state court. So in many ways, while people are familiar with and use the arbitration mediation clause in their commercial contracts, I think this is one where if you're going to go that far and you've got to use that to kind of govern how disputes are going to be adjudicated or at least resolved, think about including a little bit more detail in that in terms of the discovery aspects, because it's just true. I mean, discovery is the lion's share of the cost of any dispute resolution process. And in some ways, that might be an appropriate thing, because you got to know what your case is about, or you got to know what the dispute is about and how to resolve it, whether it's a widget, something you're building, or some service that was being provided. But still, unbridled opportunity for lawyers to run amok and just go searching for things because they think it's there, or it might be there, or it might help us, or they might ask for it. All these what-if kind of questions drive litigators. And again, without the bridle provided by the business saying, you know, we kind of thought about this ahead of time, and so while we said we wanted to go to arbitration, we wanted to go to arbitration with limits. We wanted to make sure we, from both sides' perspective, when we go into this, that it's not going to get out of control if we have a dispute. So, you know, again, kind of the same theme being repeated. It really is going back to the client's interest about how to manage risk and the exposure to cost.
So, Jay, one of the tools defendants use primarily in this e-discovery is at a certain point in time when burden becomes too high, you go right to cost shifting and say, oh, if you really want it, you're going to have to pay for it. How does cost shifting and cost allocation, how can that be addressed in a contract? And are there some benefits in doing this?
So what we did was it kind of runs through the – so if you look at our model language, which is included in the article, and if anybody wants, they send me an email and I'll send you the Word version of the model language. But if you look at it, it's kind of built in to the enforcement method, which Jonathan and I kind of call belt, suspenders, and string, because there's different levels of contractual obligation that can get struck, that can get modified by the court. So there's actually three ways it operates. The first one is waiver, meaning you, by signing this contract, you've waived your right to any discovery in excess of what we've agreed in this contract, right? So first thing, and so the basic, and that's kind of what you said there with defendants, you know, when it starts to get expensive. So before it gets expensive, we've agreed kind of what we think is reasonable for this up front. And you've waived your right to seek anything beyond that. And then it's actually a breach of the contract if you seek anything beyond that, right? So just by seeking it, you're actually breaching the contract again. And then there's also an obligation, which would leave you liable for damages of it. And then if you actually do get granted discovery in excess of it, you have an obligation to indemnify the other party for that excess cost, right? So that it builds in cost shifting for anything above the basic package that the parties agreed to at the outset. So now it doesn't say that you can get that if you just pay for it. But what it says is if you ask for it, one, you're breaching and you're liable. And two, even if the court gives it to you, you still have to pay for it. So there's sort of three levels of operation there.
So Jonathan, the boogeyman in e-discovery that most litigators fear, and also companies, is the risk of being sanctioned. Because that can kill the credibility of a lawyer. It can hurt a company that gets sued, sometimes, fairly often. And it's always like a shadow hanging over them if they get sanctioned in one case. So how do contracts help reduce the risk of sanctions?
Well, a contract gives certainty. Now, that's a simple answer. The reality is that most sanctions arise out of grave uncertainty. Sanctions have been imposed in many cases because after the fact, someone says, you knew there's reasonable anticipation of litigation. You didn't put a litigation hold in place. And, you know, reasonable minds could disagree, but a court says, oh, you did know, and someone in the business knew, but they didn't tell the lawyers. And, it, you know, once that trigger happened and no one did anything, it gave the other side an argument to cause mischief. And the idea behind contract terms is to just take the mystery out of it, take the surprise out of it, take the risk out of it, by both sides knowing that they have to give specific written notice to the other side about, hey, I think this is a dispute that's gone to the point where we reasonably anticipate litigation. Take the common law out of it and the guesswork. Also, with respect to the scope, sometimes there are disputes, and what we see in the sanctions law is people are saying you didn't go to the right custodians, didn't go to the right sources, or you didn't do the right things in terms of all, you know, grabbing everyone's cell phones or any of these kind of more extreme kinds of preservation activities that, quite frankly, people think up after the fact to say the other side didn't do it and give them an ounce of or a pound of or a ton of leverage in any given circumstance to try and point out deficiencies in process and, you know, the heck with the merits. And what we're trying to get to here is a reasoned, ordered process by which the sides discuss preservation obligations and scope. You don't have people getting jumped with respect to their trigger. That's an agreed upon event that has to have specific notice, and then everyone knows what they're supposed to do. And then the final part of it is you kind of get agreement up front to rules of the road when it comes to when something's missing. Either both parties agree they're not going to go hammer and tong about seeking, you know, true case-altering or, you know, equation-altering for business valuation purposes sanctions. And so it's like the proposed new Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 37E that has some matrix, so to speak, of considerations that says you're not supposed to have these case-altering sanctions, absence, willfulness, bad faith, and there's some exceptions with respect to certain sense where the most important thing is lost. But you can do that through contract. You don't have to wait for the, you know, Supreme Court to weigh in, promulgate it, and Congress not object 2, 3, 4, or 5 years from now, whenever that really happens. You can do it today in a contract. And so that contract would just limit each side's remedy for a breach of that particular part of the commercial relationship. So we do that all the time with limitations on liabilities. We do that all the time with respect to procedural aspects that parties can agree upon. It's a great country. We've got this power to contract as commercial entities one to another. So I just think this is a tremendous opportunity for organizations to look at and cabin the risk. Now, you can't be all-knowing and you can't be, you know, complete about any provision, right? I've seen plenty of arbitration or mediation clauses blown up because someone said that weren't properly crafted, or they could have all sorts of aspects to it where someone says, you know, the provision didn't give us the relief we really need in this particular circumstance because the parties didn't anticipate this. Well, don't let an exception like that ruin the prospect for a better, more efficient, and less costly system if you do put these things in there. So, again, to your point and your question on the sanctions, I do believe that you can agree up front on various procedural limits and substantive limits on what people will seek that would greatly reduce the risk of sanctions being imposed in a dispute resolution context, whether it's in the courtroom or before a panel of arbitrators.
Yeah, and what we actually do in the model language, what we actually do is there's a disclaimer of liability for no. So one thing is all of these are apply equally to both parties. There's no there's no this party, that party. It's no party shall be liable for the deletion or destruction of any materials unless that party had actual knowledge of the relevance, right? So there's, you know, the things we're always worried about on sanctions are, you know, negligently destroying stuff that might be relevant. So this says, okay, there's no matter what, whatever else happens, there's not going to be any liability unless you had actual knowledge of the relevance of those materials. And then the other side is, like Jonathan was saying, unless there's fraud, misrepresentation, or bad faith supported by clear and convincing evidence, right? So to a little bit higher standard, nobody can seek spoliation, adverse inference, or any of that stuff from the other party, right? So it bars you from actually seeking it unless you have clear and convincing evidence of actual fraud or something like that. So it that whole gray area, what we're trying to do is evacuate that gray area so that we've got clear lines, we know what's in, we know what's out, because the gray area is where we over-preserve, we do too much, and it costs us too much. So if we can get rid of that by having a bright line test, that's what this does here, and it works. It cuts both ways. You know, this doesn't naturally favor one party over the other, which brings up other issues because you have to be careful with this kind of thing in other situations. But in a contract of two sophisticated parties of roughly equal bargaining power, I think you're going to be good here.
Now, I can think of some downsides to this, and that you've already sort of alluded to the one, two sophisticated parties, you know. But would there be instances where you could think of where maybe a contract might not be enforceable, like maybe employment agreements or something like that between a big company and an individual? I don't do you have to be careful about when you think these things are going to work?
Yeah, the way I look at it, a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step. This article is shooting just at commercial contracts. It's not, you know, you want to be careful. Labor and employment agreements, consumer agreements, I would be careful on all of those. I wouldn't necessarily rely on it. Although, you know, there's now these things can be, you know, I can see. So even since we wrote this article, you know, now it's becoming a case where on some agreements, people, you know, their social media becomes at issue, right? So in a labor, like let's say in an employment dispute or something like that, this might help them in that kind of situation. You don't know. So it may be, there may be applicability in the future for those kind of business to consumer or employer employee type of things. But right now we've kind of aimed this squarely at the commercial market.
Yeah, the other risk that I sort of struck me, if people were doing this in large numbers, is the risk of lawyers trying to solve a technical problem in a contract. I mean, I agree. The trigger, this is a no-brainer. I think you'd be silly not to. You wouldn't find a lawyer out there that wouldn't agree that's a good idea, I think, in the field. But I have seen people try to limit search terms and things like that, which, you know, pushes us in a direction of approaches that we use today in large numbers, but some people, you know, like myself, are out there saying we should do other approaches, and you know, contracts may hold us back. You're not thinking forward when you're drafting them at the same time, that would be one of my concerns as well.
I agree with that. We drafted it pretty broadly and not to tie, you know, I wouldn't say we future-proofed it, but we tried not to tie it to any specific practice. I don't think we mentioned keywords or anything like that in there. We do call out to the cooperation principles. There's a lot, it talks about all that stuff, all those best practices. We tried not to have it be siloed into sort of how we do things today, because the fact of the matter is you could sign this contract today, but be litigating it 10, 15 years down the road too. So we tried to make it, you know, for the ages.
Yeah. It's, you know, the challenge of agreeing, and it sounds like you're front loading some of your meet and confer and you don't even have a dispute yet, but there's some common sense things in here that I just think are great ideas. I'm a big fan of it. So, with that in mind, I do think we've sort of covered most of this. I guess if anyone listens to this, reach out to Jay or Jonathan, you guys would send them a copy of the article, I'm sure, right?
Yes.
And the last question I have, and feel free to add anything else that maybe I haven't asked you, here we are on September 27, 2013. You know, what issue do you see as the biggest issue in the e-discovery field right now? And I always like hearing what people are seeing. So, Jonathan, I'll start with you and Jay second.
The biggest issue?
Boy. Yeah, what's your whale issue?
Well, I could be flipping it and say that's like asking me to pick out the drunkest man at Mardi Gras. The reality is, I think there are several issues that are floating about the whole concept of getting to perspective and reality in terms of preservation, that there really are significant costs and there should be discussions. We're slowly getting there, but there's more work. And I think there's a true dearth of lawyers that actually understand this, and there's a whole raft of cases that are going forward with either bad advocacy or no advocacy or strained advocacy on these issues that are really hurting clients' short-term and long-term interests. It's a very grave issue, in my view, for the whole practice in terms of ethics, duties to clients, and competence. I think there are issues with respect to the whole search and retrieval that confront us. A lot of people run to predictive analytics and say this is the best thing since sliced bread. Well, we never use sliced bread for discovery and never will. So is it really the right tool? Understanding what is the right tool, what's the right approach? We shouldn't just run to it and dismiss that actually searching for keywords can sometimes work. Searching and asking custodians where things are might be the first place to go. And so sometimes people are running to these magic answers, and that's not the way it works. So I'm really concerned about people chasing technologies if that's the magic answer. I think that's a huge issue out there as well. I think finally, the heart of the system, when we think about the civil rules, both federal and state level, and what really was embodied in the 1983 amendments to the rules, based on the work of Judge Brazil at that time and others in the committee, was this whole notion of proportionality. And that's gotten a lot of sway in the last several years. The whole idea of Sedona cooperation, other things, are all based on the parties being able to sit down and think about what is this case really about, and is the proposed discovery tool I am using worth the candle? Is that request worth the candle? Is it worth the effort in what I will get back? And it goes to what Jay said at the very beginning of the program about, you know, every trial comes down to a handful of documents or pieces of electronic data, and we just need to jump to that end view and perspective and then apply proportionality across this. And we're still not at a place in our system. We're still not at a place where the lawyers understand that the vast potential technology, the vast amounts of data we've got to really think about and how to get to that end point with clients' interest and the system's interest at heart. We're still far away from an efficient dispute resolution system, and unfortunately, without the competence, without addressing some of these other issues, getting beyond the fear of technology as well as the over-love of technology and doing this right, without that, we are getting to a point in our system where it could break. We are not efficient at doing this, and the inefficiencies could swamp and, in fact, outprice the courts from being an effective place where people can go for justice, and that would be a sad reality if we get there.
And Jay, how about yourself?
I'd have to say the thing that worries me is, well, step back for a little. So all of us in the e-discovery world, we live or die on emails and documents, and structured data and databases are never quite as, you know, sometimes we do a report out of them, sometimes we do some analysis off of them, but they're usually not as important to us or as problematic as email, as unstructured, right? But the problem I see coming down the pike is the proliferation of big data, where it's going to wash us away. So we do a lot of information governance work, and the problem is now you have so many, so if you know, the Internet of Things or the Industrial Internet or these things that are storing data, you know, 26,000 data points a second or something like that, and they're storing it and they're keeping it all, and people are making business decisions on it all, and pretty soon that stuff is going to come up in litigation, and how do we analyze that? That's going to be a whole new task. The size of the data sets are going to dwarf anything we've thought of before, and the skill sets are going to be a lot different for analyzing that level of big data. So to me, you know, what's going to turn this industry upside down over the next 5 years is going to be, and I hate to use a, you know, the catchphrase du jour, but big data, I think, is going to change everything for us in our business here.
You know, and I'll chime in because I see all those problems as being big, and the one that common theme that I look at them is when you have big problems, you got to think a little differently sometimes. And I, I see the lack of entrepreneurial thinking in the legal community. To me, is just sad and frustrating. You know, I've been fortunate that I've had a couple of big projects over the last few years where I've been able to use some new technology and have yet to have anything but a really big success. And it's not like it's impossible to do, because the risks are not so great when you consider the speed advantages. And by and large, I think the judiciary totally supports creative thinking. And I have something I'll be writing on it soon on a recent case we just finished. And, you know, I just don't think it's that difficult to try to attack problems a new way, because the problems aren't going to go away with the current thinking. You know, there's not enough manpower to solve these problems. It's big data now. But anyway, that's my basic, you know, thought right now. Anyway, I want to thank Jay and Jonathan for both prompting me to do another ESI Bites, and I hope to get a few more scheduled soon. But it's always a pleasure to have people like yourselves share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. I'd also like to thank my good friend Tim Opsitnik at Jernov for their continued support and hosting of ESI Bites. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can remember it phonetically. It sounds out as Easy Bytes of ESI information, but however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.